You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also chat with us on Twitter by going to twitter.com/thetakeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
Try and understand your man the best you can.
Great song from a great band about the Great Divide. We're going to consider the ancient divisions of Europe and look at whether the Ukraine crisis is actually a sign that Vladimir Putin of Russia is trying to reinstate the divisions of Europe during the Cold War or even earlier. In the age of GPS, is Putin relying on maps from the Napoleonic era? For most of us, the Great Divide is the unprecedented income disparities in America that complicate our politics and stifle the economy. We'll do a little GPS analysis of how incomes are shaking out post-recession and see which zip codes actually qualify as being post-recession. We'll also take a look at the ancient tradition of science explainer, from Galileo to Darwin to Carl Sagan to the proliferation of science voices today. Physicist Brian Cox will be with us. And we imagine a planet overpopulated with well-meaning humans and their obsession with adorable, fluffy creatures, endangered species that make us all go,
aww.
Are the cute pandas and lemurs and koala bears of the world the best contributors to biodiversity? We begin with a $15 billion deal, though, between Russia and Ukraine that leaders of both countries hope buys them time to stem political unrest in the streets of Kiev, Ukraine's capital. Russia will buy $15 billion in Ukrainian debt and offer Ukraine cheaper energy, a lifeline from Russia's Vladimir Putin to Ukraine's Viktor Yanukovych. Our first conversation is with Zbigniew Brzezinski, former national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter, a professor at Johns Hopkins University, and a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Brzezinski says the big question is whether there are secret deals in this agreement to try and pull Ukraine back from Europe, to try and slow what Brzezinski believes is an inevitable march toward the West, that Vladimir Putin's vision of a reunited Soviet empire ultimately cannot stop.
I don't think it's a futuristic vision. I think it's a nostalgic vision because it is not based on reality. Who wants to be part of an empire after having been independent? Independent statehood is very gratifying and very contagious. And once you have tasted it, you don't want to give it up. So if compulsion was used here to get Yanukovych to concede, I strongly fear that there will be a very, very negative reaction from many Ukrainians, the majority of which wants to move towards Europe, a minority of which seems more comfortable with Russia, but they're not particularly convinced of that either because they know from experience that it really means subordination.
Do you think the Slavic identity question is settled in Europe, even if the question of whether the EU offers more economic security than Russia does is still up in the air?
The Ukrainians, and particularly the younger generation that has grown up under the Ukrainian flag, feel themselves to be Ukrainians. Slav is a kind of a generalized description of several peoples that have certain things in common, including particularly linguistically. But that's like saying that the Italians, the Portuguese, the Spaniards, and so forth all belong to some sort of a Roman nation. It's a cultural fiction to some extent, which the Russians have propagated because it made it easier for them to justify domination of others from Moscow.
Can the troubles in the EU become an argument for Vladimir Putin to at least argue, as he has in the past, that he has the capacity to create a union that is a peer with the EU, sort of a rival of the EU, a set of equals there on the continent?
Well, I don't think they're equal, because if you look at the GNP or at the level of international trade, or at comparative standards of living, there's just no comparison between Europe, the member nations of the European Union, and the putative member states of the Eurasian Union. The question is, might there be some secret promises here? And I think the Ukrainian people, who have tasted independence and who have tasted freedom, have a right to demand a full accounting from Yanukovych of what was promised, what was written down, what was signed and what perhaps was only whispered about. And in other words, the full story of this arrangement has to be exposed. And then people can make a general sort of judgment of how acceptable this is. Theoretically, one could say, fine, if Russia gives Ukraine a big loan and if Russia gives Ukraine energy at a lower price, that's a good thing if Ukraine at the same time can move towards Europe and if in Ukraine's wake, subsequently, Russia also moves towards Europe, because Russia will be far more stable, far more potentially wealthy, and far more secure if it is part of a larger Europe than if it ends up in a kind of fake union between a dynamic and expanding China in the Far East and a much stronger and popularly supported European Union in the West.
Well, you make precisely this sort of Peter the Great argument in your piece in the Financial Times. Is it inevitable that Russia go the European direction? And if so, is Vladimir Putin the only one standing in the way right now?
Well, he certainly is standing in the way, but he has some people supporting him. The former Soviet institutions, the institutions of power, the secret services, the secret police, the armed forces, some of the bureaucracy, some of the oligarchs, and some of the population, particularly the more primitive types, who are swept up by a new sense of nationalism. He has their support, but I think they represent the past. And therefore, my vision of the future is either Russia accommodates the Ukraine moving to the West and then follows suit in some time to come, or it creates some sort of an impediment which will then collapse. Ukraine will leave on its own anyway to the West, and eventually after Putin is gone, Russia will try to recoup, but will lose 5, 10, 15, or maybe even 20 years in the process.
I can't resist this. Were you asked in the course of your government service whether you would live to see the end of the Soviet Union, and did you answer negatively to that question?
I don't think I was asked, but I was sort of expecting it, and towards the end I was predicting it. But I've never claimed to be a prophet. I was always confident, however, that we could help to dismantle the Soviet Union.
Do you think you will live to see this vision that you've just outlined?
It could happen.
All right, Zbigniew Brzezinski, thank you very much.
Good to talk to you. All the best.
Zbigniew Brzezinski is former National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter. One more sign that Vladimir Putin may be out of step with the times. President Obama has named two openly gay athletes, tennis icon Billie Jean King and Caitlin Cahill, a hockey player, as delegates at the Winter Olympics in Sochi. It's a direct confrontation to the anti-gay policies in Russia that Putin has not challenged. The Olympics may be another challenge to Putin on an even bigger international stage. So what of this inevitable march toward Europe by Ukraine and eventually Russia? Is Zbigniew Brzezinski correct here? This Kiev resident, Vladimir Trunovpol, would say yes.
We believe that everything will be okay and Euromaidan will win.
Euromaidan is the name that these dissidents who spoke with the Associated Press give to the movement in Kiev's independent square to renounce Russia and embrace the West. Boris Potapkenko is the former president and current vice president of the Ukrainian Congress Committee in Detroit. He joins us now. Welcome, Boris.
Hi.
So what do you think of the Brzezinski notion that Ukraine is inevitably bound for the West and ultimately even Russia?
Well, curiously enough, in 1978, a prominent Ukrainian dissident was released from the Soviet Union when Zbigniew Brzezinski was National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter. And I had the pleasure or distinct obligation to accompany Mr. Valentin Moroz and to translate for him and to advise him. And we met with Dr. Brzezinski in his offices in the West Wing, where I had my first encounter face-to-face with who is, for the Ukrainian community, a very famous advocate of Ukrainian rights.
You know, one of the things that Brzezinski told us that actually didn't make it into that conversation you just heard was pretty interesting, in that this energy deal that's just been announced actually says to the people on the streets of Kiev just how much the Russians have been ripping off the Ukrainians on energy questions. Do you think that will inflame things, even though this subsidy does economically ease the pain a little bit?
The Ukrainian people are well aware of the inflated prices. In fact, former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko was imprisoned on the allegation that she had negotiated this bad deal with Putin on gas prices.
What do you think the effect of this $15 billion purchase of Ukrainian debt will mean? Does it forestall a move towards Europe? Does it actually make people on the street believe that Russia is a warm embrace, an ally here?
The problem in Ukraine today is that President Yanukovych has lost all credibility, and any deal that he would make with Putin would be extremely suspect. And until the details of the deal are made public, and the details that are not made public are the ones that are going to be left to suspicion. Vladimir Putin has made no secret that he is expending every effort to make sure that Ukraine is brought back into Russia's fold and is not allowed to move towards the European Union. And the Ukrainian people are totally aware of this, and that is why they are in Euromaidan.
Do you believe, you alluded to this moments ago, quickly, do you believe that there are secret agreements for Ukraine to join the customs union with Russia in this Yanukovych deal?
I think that's a foregone conclusion that Putin would not have rescinded the exorbitant gas prices or extended $15 billion out of goodwill.
Boris Potapkenko is a Detroit-based activist and vice chair of the International Conference in Support of Ukraine. He doesn't appear to have a lot of trust in Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych's denials that there are any secret deals with the Russians. You've been discussing trust in a different context. We asked journalist Glenn Greenwald this week, who helped Edward Snowden publish classified documents about the NSA, whether journalists can be trusted, and he told us no.
Journalism can be abused in all sorts of ways. And I think the question always is the journalist in question acting responsibly or not? And like every profession, journalists have some responsible people and some irresponsible ones.
Government, the media, who do you trust?
Hi, this is Kathleen from Maui, and I believe the only way to trust government is to take money out of politics so that honest people with good intentions can devote themselves to running the country.
My name is Asia Jacobson, and I'm calling from Oahu, Hawaii, and I absolutely do not trust the government. It seems like there's way too much of a disconnect between my life and Washington.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of that conversation. Find us, too, at facebook.com/TheTakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
From maps of Europe and Asia to a very different kind of map, can economic data create a map of the 99% of Americans in relationship to the 1% of Americans at the highest income levels? An economic topographic look at the elevations and big drop-offs in Americans' incomes. Well, the U.S. Census Bureau has just released the latest data on median household income across the country, and our friends at WNYC have used this data to create an interactive map that allows you to explore everything from the macro picture nationwide down to your state, to your county. Check it out at www.thetakeaway.org. We want to take a journey now from far out in space down to the street corners of America with Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project at American University in Washington. Dante, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me back.
So I'm on this spaceship. I'm coming towards Earth. I get to the point where I can see the United States, and I'm pretty much seeing from, 50 million miles out that the whole of the United States is kind of the 1%. But as I get closer, as I come in and start to see differentiation between North, South, East, and West, how does that begin to shake out?
Well, the first thing you'll notice as you're coming in is these areas around the cities they're not maybe the 1%, but you know, you see a breakout in there, and you see wealthy areas and places that we call the urban suburbs. And you know, there are places like Montgomery County in Maryland, actually Montgomery County in Pennsylvania, Oakland County in Michigan. These places are doing quite well economically, very well. And then as you get further out into more rural places, you watch the incomes sort of drop off.
So let's take this topographically, like a 3D map. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like you've got like ring mountain ranges around these sort of donut hole city neighborhoods. Let's say I'm standing on the high income cliffs with a fabulous view of the 99%. Where am I?
Where are you? You are standing just outside of New York City, maybe. Or maybe you're standing in the middle of Manhattan, looking out and around. And as you see out, you watch things get flatter and flatter until you get way out into Appalachia, which is about as flat as you can possibly get.
All right, so let's think of places that are relatively unstable. Let's think geologically, like a volcanic zone, all right? Right. Bubbling magma of turmoil and change, income speaking. Where am I now?
Right now, I think when you're looking at the bubbling magma, you're probably looking at, you actually might be looking at the middle of the cities, to be honest, which are really changing very rapidly. And you've got a lot of intense wealth and a lot of intense poverty packed in very close together. You guys know this very well in Manhattan.
And maybe even more down in a place like Miami.
Absolutely.
Now, what about places, and you've alluded to this a little bit with Appalachia, where nothing ever changes? I mean, in income terms, where are the Badlands, Death Valley?
You're looking at a bunch of counties in Kentucky, counties like Casey County, Cumberland County, Wayne County in Kentucky. Down, you're going to see some of them in Missouri, Texas County, Missouri. You're going to see places that are really, really unchanging, very stable. I mean, when you think of Texas County, Missouri, and you think of some of these places in Appalachia, to use a different metaphor, think of the movie a few years back set in Missouri with Jennifer Lawrence, Winter's Bone. That's what you're looking at. Those places have been the same for a very long time. And those are the flat, unchanging, kind of troubled places in America that aren't getting any better. They're just staying where they are and where they have been for quite some time.
Now, part of the mission of creating this map and using this census data to give us a sort of GPS kind of view of income disparities and income distribution in the United States is to try to make the case for where the recession is still happening and where the recovery is happening. What does that tell you?
When I look at all these numbers, what I'm seeing is most places got better, particularly using the American Communities Project. Most places got better. But three places did not get better. In fact, three places got worse, and they've been getting worse now for basically since the 2000 census. And those places are working class country, which is, again, Appalachia, but we're talking about where things that are flat and been bad for a long time. And these places we call graying America. And this is kind of rural America. Much older. Both those places, more than 20% of the population is over 65. And when I look at those places, I really want to see the next ACS. And if those places are still going down, it's not really a question even of whether the recovery has started there. Looking at those places, I wonder if they're going to get a recovery, or I wonder if they're just slipping away as rural America really kind of falls off. It's a troubling trend, and it really, I think, it bears watching over the next year.
Does it mean that places in rural America, really vast acreages in rural America, will become like ghost towns of the 21st century?
I'm starting to wonder that. In fact, we have some other data we're working on with you guys at the Takeaway and up in New York, where we're starting to see some things in terms of housing, empty houses. That's one thing that's starting to rise out of that. And what's happening is it's a brain drain from rural America into urban America and suburban America, kind of metropolitan America. And it's a trend that really, really bears watching, because we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do with some of the places in the country that seem to be falling behind pretty dramatically.
Dante Cini is director of the American Communities Project at American University in Washington, D.C. If you want to go and see this map that's compiled from the American Communities Project and U.S. Census data put together by our friends at WNYC, you can check it out at www.thetakeaway.org. Dante, thanks so much.
Thanks, and thanks for the trip to the world today.
Now, we really want you to go play around with this map that shows income levels by county, put together by our friends here at WNYC Data News with U.S. Census data. You just go to thetakeaway.org, and if you find yourself close to that exact middle, we want to hear from you. Let us know your profession, a few details about your life. What are you saving for? Do you have savings? Do you feel like you're climbing up or slipping below that middle? Who is in the middle? If it's you, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We may invite you onto the show tomorrow to talk more about your experiences.
This is Eric. I'm calling from Oregon. I trust my government to do one thing, and that is to support and protect the interests of the 1%.
Eric there was making an economic point about an earlier conversation we've been having all week regarding trust in government. How have the revelations of NSA surveillance programs affected your idea of trust in government and other institutions?
Sam from Georgia, and yeah, I trust in my government. I ain't got nothing to hide on my phone. If you got something to hide, then you need not trust the government.
Who do you trust? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway. All one word, at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Last night's Mega Millions lottery prize hit $636 million, and it went to two lucky winners, one in San Jose, California, the other in Atlanta, Georgia. The jackpot numbers 8, 14, 17, 20, 39. Hey, those are the jersey numbers of my favorite players for the 1984 Chicago Bears football team. Oh, man, I blew it. One of you in Huntington, West Virginia has a system. I've played the same numbers every drawing for more than 3 years, longer than my last relationship. I still have my ex's birthday in the mix, though. And if that number comes in, does the ex come calling?
Well, congratulations. You finally won the lottery. Shirley Jackson's the lottery.
Right, Shirley Jackson's lottery in the famous short story, A Stoning. Not exactly anybody's idea of easy street. Susan Bradley joins us now, founder of the Sudden Money Institute. I love that name, Susan.
Thank you.
So when is a lottery winning kind of like being stoned in the sense that it doesn't become the most positive development in your life and actually hurts?
You know, it does happen, but it can be corrected, unlike stoning could be corrected. What some people say it feels like is they've been shot through a cannon from maybe like a pastoral setting of the family farm onto Times Square. And then they find out that they can't get home from Times Square.
And how do you advise people like this? I mean, what do you tell them?
Well, you know, it's a different kind of financial planning. What we do at the Sudden Money Institute is we train financial transitionists because it's an adaptive change planning process rather than a technical planning change process, which means that we work with people on how it feels and their relationships, the commitments they're making, the reworking of their hopes and dreams. It seems like everything falls apart and needs to get put back together again. The money part is what instigates this, but it doesn't become so much about the money. It becomes about the personal change side of it.
So is your first advice, throw away your cell phone, get a new number, change your address?
Yes.
Really?
Not necessarily change your address, but definitely get a new phone number. The onslaught is fairly severe if you go public with this. And in most lotteries, you have to disclose your name. Sometimes you have to have what they euphemistically call a photo op when you collect your winnings.
What is the most ridiculous first purchase a lottery winner in your experience ever made?
It's kind of a funny thing. One person bought a town.
I love it. I was driving home with somebody last night, and he was telling me I would get an island.
Okay, same thing.
And it's those kinds of things that you definitely advise against.
Yeah, and this town wasn't, as you can imagine, much of a town, and it was very isolated, and it didn't turn out all that well, but it was an interesting adventure for them.
as financial planning goes, what's more fun or more challenging? Helping people who have almost no money try to get to retirement, or helping people with an embarrassment of riches like this?
You know, it's funny that it's actually people with small amounts, because you can build a system for that. You can build a, you know, save more, spend less, don't make any big mistakes, be consistent, be disciplined, and eventually you get to a goal. And with these folks, let's say that they had been doing that. Now they kind of fall into this abyss. And the abyss is, it's not a comfortable place. It's fun in some ways. There are a lot of good things about it, but
it's an abyss. And we all love to fall into it, but we hope you're there with us. Susan Bradley is founder of the Sudden Money Institute in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Thanks so much, Susan.
My pleasure.
We want to remind you of a conversation we've been having all week on trust in government and trust that the government will not overreach its power.
My name is Asia Jacobson, and I'm calling from Oahu, Hawaii, and I absolutely do not trust the government. Seems like there's way too much of a disconnect between my life and Washington.
Thanks, AJ. Disconnect, maybe, or perhaps too much connection. This conversation was motivated by the U.S. District Court decision this week to declare the National Security Agency's surveillance programs unconstitutional. Is this a conversation headed to the U.S. Supreme Court? The answer to that, according to Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, is a very strong maybe.
Well, for sure, the government's going to appeal to the Federal Appeals Court in Washington. And that court has issued decisions which suggest that they may be open to this challenge to the program. But in the end, it's up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's got decisions that point in both directions about how it may come out on this issue of whether the NSA phone program collecting up the phone records of all Americans violates the Fourth Amendment.
Will there be a plethora of challenges of individual programs involving individual defendants? And who has standing here? I mean, anybody with a phone?
There are two kinds of basic challenges. One would be someone who's prosecuted as a consequence of information gathered through this program. And that person can go into court and say, you should suppress this evidence against me because it violated the Constitution when you collected it. I don't think that's the likely way this gets to the Supreme Court. More likely is either the decision from Monday, which was brought by a conservative activist, or parallel challenges brought by civil liberties groups, the ACLU or the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which challenge it more broadly. But what's interesting about these cases, as opposed to earlier ones, is there doesn't seem to be a standing problem, because it does seem that the government has all but conceded that they basically gather up everybody's phone records.
What about a challenge from one of the private sector players here, like a Google or an AT&T or a Verizon?
It's not impossible, but for them, it's a little more complicated to demonstrate how they've been harmed. Congress has granted them immunity from lawsuits against them. And I guess they could argue, and have been telling the president, apparently, that it hurts their business, that people know that in going through them, the government might collect records. But given that every phone company's records apparently are collected, it's hard. I don't know that I have a choice but to use one of them.
Is it the case that the bar is extremely high for an injunction that would shut down the program, but a broader challenge that would retroactively kill the program is much more likely?
Well, this judge did issue an injunction, and if there is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, as he found, I don't think either retrospective or prospective relief, an injunction being prospective relief, is out of the question.
All right. Finally, what are the clues on the Supreme Court itself of people's justices' interest in this issue?
There are two basic Supreme Court decisions to look at, and they point in opposite directions. An old one from 1979 said that if you give the telephone company your records, if you give a third party your records, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy about what's done with those records. But that was done in a very different era, where an individual robber phone was monitored for outgoing calls for 2 days. And we live in a very different age now, as Judge Leon pointed out on Monday. The other interesting Supreme Court case from 2012 unanimously said that the government had been wrong to put a GPS device on somebody's car and follow him around for a month and gather up a real trove of data. That case is particularly interesting because five justices, although only in concurrences, said that gathering huge amounts of data that could provide a mosaic about somebody's entire life might well violate that person's legitimate expectations of privacy. And if you apply that logic to the NSA program, you basically get to where the district judge got, and that would suggest that it could be struck down.
The big idea here may go way beyond national security. We may end up in these cases defining what the right of privacy finally once and for all is in the 21st century.
Well, that's right. The right of privacy in the digital age is really open field. And I'm not sure most privacy advocates are eager to have the Supreme Court decide it for the first time in the national security context. But it sure would be interesting to see what they have to say.
Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent. Thanks so much.
Good to be here.
We're going to finish out this hour with two very different looks at the popular messaging of science. Hollywood and sci-fi geeks are in love with sexy black holes and galaxy clusters, stellar nebulae and supernovas, you know that. Much less so with boring neutrinos, ions, and asteroids, even though they might have more to do with our day-to-day lives here on Earth, especially a colliding asteroid. Oh, yeah. In a moment, physicist Brian Cox on the importance of understanding the real principles of physics in our day-to-day lives. But first, from a biological perspective, we may intellectually understand that biodiversity on our planet is a good thing, but that doesn't make us any more affectionate towards, say, the longhorn beetle. Nice beetle. I don't suppose you named it or anything. Anybody want to adopt this golden-rumped elephant shrew? I guess it looks a little bit like an elephant. Ew. But start talking about adorable panda bears going extinct, and suddenly there's not a dry eye in the house.
Let's call her Squeaky.
You know, if we pick the species to save based on this survival of the cuteness principle, the planet could become a lost world of fluffy, adorable, cuddly, useless species surrounded by starving humans and I guess a lot of ants and flies with no fear of predators because they all went extinct. Joining us now, Christine Delamore is a news editor for NationalGeographic.com. She joined us today from Washington, D.C. Christine, welcome.
Hi.
So tell me about this special last of the last series that you're doing at National Geographic, which really explores our psychological connection to what endangered species we fall in love with and what ones we have a difficult time connecting with, but maybe more important.
Sure. Well, we noticed on our website that unusual rare species were really resonating with our audience because they were giving people an opportunity to learn about an animal they might not have ever heard before, you know, beyond the panda or the tiger. So we wanted to take a closer look at some of these species that are disappearing without our, you know, without the wider world knowing about them, and also take a deeper dive into how we're prioritizing what to save and what are some creative methods for bringing these species back.
Do humans have a decent track record when they get mobilized of saving species, or is it just very symbolic kind of zoo business?
They actually do. A good example is the California condor. In the 90s, that had declined to about 22 animals, and there was a concerted effort to breed the bird in captivity and then release it back into the wild. And it's amazing that it's recovered to about 200 animals. And a conservationist told me a few weeks ago he saw one flying through the Grand Canyon. So there you have a success story. The gray wolf, for example, has rebounded in the West. The northern elephant seal has also come back. So conservation can work, and it's proven to work in many cases.
You know, your project reminds me of the snail darter controversy. Do you remember that?
The fish, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was a species of weird creature that actually blocked the building of a dam and became a big political firestorm back in the 80s when conservatives said that the environmental movement had overreached, and it was very, very difficult to have anybody fall in love with the snail darter.
Right.
And, how many of these kinds of political battles can we expect to see?
Right. Well, there are a lot of funders and a lot of governments like to rally around the well-known species, for example, the panda bears. And that helps get funding for the animal. But there's another strategy that's emerging that a lot of nonprofit groups are embracing, which is if you save the tiger's entire range, you might also protect a lot of the animals that live in the range, for example, the pygmy hog that nobody knows about. So it kind of is indirectly benefiting under this umbrella of protection. So conservationists are recognizing that people like these well-known fuzzy species, but they're also trying to devise ways to save the lesser-known ones at the same time.
So take a bigger view than just species and
exactly.
try to look at ecosystems where you have interrelated
yes.
people who will pull each other up.
Yes.
Now, what about creating a set of priorities that assigns a value to a species based on its importance in the ecosystem as opposed mm-hmm. to simply what it looks like?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is an algorithm that's kind of gaining popularity that looks at it from a mathematical perspective. I'm not aware of one that looks at the ecosystem value, although there are conservationists who argue, you know, we should save ants as opposed to pandas because ants are so valuable to the environment. The mathematical model is interesting. Australia just this week decided that its national conservation strategy would be looking at how to save species through a cost-effective method. So how do they get the most bang for their buck? New Zealand adopted it, I believe, last year. So, you know, that model seems to be rising to the forefront.
Does something like the project prioritization protocol
exactly
get us away
yes.
from these cuteness things that you know, float the panda to the top?
I think so. You know, it definitely depends on what situation you're in and you know, the players that you're working with. But the key is to try to, you know, rally as many people as you can around the idea that species are important and that, you know, there are often moral and economic and ethical reasons to save them. Like, there's not just one reason.
Finally, I mean, you can raise money around the pandas and use the money for something besides pandas. I mean, the pandas aren't going to know the difference.
That's true. Yeah, that was something that a lot of conservationists mentioned, too. For example, you know, trying to change people's perceptions of shark fin soup in Asia. You might dedicate some of your funding not only to conserve sharks, but also to educate people that putting shark fins in your soup is not the best idea. So conservation funds can be used for a lot of different strategies and methods to try to change people's values in that way.
Christine Delamore is news editor for NationalGeographic.com. They're doing a series on endangered species and how we view them as conservationists. Christine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we asked you guys to choose between three endangered species, the giant panda, the gray-faced elephant shrew, and the American burying beetle. What would you save? 58% said the panda. Come on, you guys are so predictable. No surprises there. 38% picked the shrew. We'd like to invite you all to a shrew party here in New York City. And only 4% would save the beetle. See, these are my people. Poor little beetle. You can take our poll online at thetakeaway.org. Earlier this hour, we asked, who do you trust? And we got this great answer from St. Peter's, Missouri. Science. And I don't mean scientists. I just mean science. Coming up, another look at science and messaging, a new documentary series trying to instill a trust in science in the public. British physicist Brian Cox is up next. Stay with us. So we see the danger of distorted, excessively sentimental messaging in the biological world. What about in physics? As a passionate science explainer, the late Carl Sagan, understanding science, and particularly physics, was a matter of life and death.
We've reached a point where there can be no more special interests or special cases. Nuclear arms threaten every person on the Earth. We have heard the rationales offered by the superpowers. We know who speaks for the nations. But who speaks for the human species? Who speaks for Earth?
Sagan speaking there in his famous series Cosmos, which planted the seeds for a whole new generation of science and physics explainers, including Sagan protege, physicist, and BBC science broadcaster Brian Cox. Cox says Sagan's legacy is getting scientists to realize that if they don't step up like Galileo to argue against distortion and myth, they will lose the war for truth, even if they win the battle of being correct.
It's an interesting debate, actually, that over the years and decades that people have been presenting science, particularly on television, that there's always been a sense in which it's frowned upon by certain elements in the scientific community. I think that's less true now. And the reason is that we've realized as a community that we have to explain our science. We have to convince people, the public who pay for a lot of this science, that it's worth doing. And also, a lot of us believe that the more scientific our society is, the better it will be. I mean, Carl Sagan, one of my heroes, always pointed out that we live in societies now, in a civilization that rests on foundations of science and engineering. They are, in many ways, the reason we have a civilization. So in a democracy, if you have a large number of people, and perhaps the majority, who know nothing about science, then it's, first of all, it's anti-democratic. But secondly, you're in danger of making bad decisions. And the big decisions that we face now as a civilization have scientific answers, be them questions about climate change or energy provision. All those things require scientific answers. And so you need a scientific literate population. And I think that's new thinking, actually. That realization has come quite late to the scientific community, as you imply.
So back to these characters. You say Carl Sagan is a hero of yours. Is he an evangelizer? Is he a marketer of science? Is he, I don't know, what is he, an entertainer?
All of those. I think he was also a polemicist. And that one of the things that I found compelling about Cosmos was that it had a point of view, and particularly the very famous 13th episode, which was absolutely about the big issue of the time, or one of the big issues, which was the threat of nuclear war, which is all that nuclear war, that threat has receded somewhat now. But so Sagan used a scientific documentary to talk about this stupidity, the futility of that kind of position. He was very interested, actually, in one of the great questions, the so-called SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And himself and Frank Drake and others were very concerned by the fact that we don't see any evidence of any other civilizations anywhere in the Milky Way galaxy. Never seen a hint of evidence. And the thing, just recently, there was a remarkable number published from the data from the Kepler telescope, which is looking for planets around other stars. It's estimated there are 20 billion Earth-like planets in the so-called habitable zone around stars in the Milky Way. One in five stars, probably, or maybe one in 10 stars, have a habitable Earth-like planet around them, we think, based on the small number of measurements we've got. So this really brings that into focus. Where are those civilizations? Sagan felt that probably what happens is they destroy themselves. So they don't live very long. They get to a certain level of technological maturity and destroy themselves. So what I found compelling about Cosmos was he put that into the documentary. So it was a polemic. He was saying to us, you know, we have to behave better. We're on the verge of destroying ourselves. And that possibly that's what all civilizations do.
Well, Sagan took on as his personal mission the sense that nuclear war is futile, actually could destroy the species, and here's the scientific rationale for that, and also that the search for extraterrestrial life and the space program is something we should absolutely continue doing. It's a part of our being. Your colleague Neil deGrasse Tyson says some of the same kinds of things. What is your mission to explain, to turn people on fire over?
I think it's something Sagan also touched on in his book, The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark, which is that the facts, the things that we've learned about the universe are wonderful and capture people's imagination. But I think equally important, or perhaps more important, is speaking about what it means to make a scientific statement, what doing science actually is. So when we talk about a so-called controversial subject, certainly in political circles, like global warming, man-made global warming, is the climate heating up because of our actions? People need to know what those models mean, what it means to say we've taken some measurements, we've measured the sea temperatures and the ice areas in the Arctic and all those things, and we've got these computer models and they predict this. space within some kind of range with errors. What that means, because it's quite technical, it's very technical, it's very difficult. What we're talking about with science is we're trying to understand the natural world, the world that is out there. We're observing it, trying to understand how it works. That's got nothing to do with whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or whatever you are. But I think that obviously that issue is a very good one to address these issues, because it's all mixed up. You know, mostly the people who don't like the science will be Republicans, right? But mostly, just broadly speaking. And the people that like the science will be Democrats. And that shows you that there's something wrong with the public debate. There's a misunderstanding, because science is completely blind to politics.
And in your mission, I guess, scientists deal with an enormous amount of uncertainty. But at a certain point, you have to kind of say, all right, this is a settled question.
It's the big problem with communicating science, but it's the strength of science. The reason it works is because there are no absolute truths. You're never right. So given that we're never right, you know, it's always open to reinterpretation and challenge. Science, it gives you answers that are the best you can do, given the available data. There's no doubt about that. It's obvious, actually. If you look at the way our civilization has developed, the knowledge we use to build aeroplanes or to build power stations or to build mobile phones, cell phones, whatever it is that you want, that it's obviously based on scientific discovery at some point in the past. So it's that simple idea that while science is never right, there are no absolute truths in science, therein lies its strength, always open to challenge. It is, however, the best you can do if you want to answer a question, a well-posed question, like, is it true that burning fossil fuels changes the climate? And if so, by how much? That's a scientific question.
Let's end on a non-scientific question that will be an absolute truth. Brian Cox, what's your favorite color?
My favorite color? Blue. The color of the sky.
And on that note, Brian Cox, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Cox is a leading British physicist and a science broadcaster on the BBC. We want to encourage you to be a part of this conversation we've been having all week on trust in government and institutions, and even whether the government has some trust issues.
My name is Charlie. I'm from Arlington, Texas, and I have trust issues all the way from the local police all the way up to the highest levels of government. It seems like nobody these days is taking into account the fact that 99% of us are innocent and have nothing to do with any sort of crimes, yet we're all being treated as criminals and terrorists.
That's it for this hour. The Great Divides, Europe, economic, the great trust divide in America today. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, go to thetakeaway.org. Get in touch at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. I nearly wrote my will, but I changed my mind for the better. I never still had my fill.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.